Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, fixing the Medicare prescription plan that was supposed to fix Medicare. But first, a new storm has hit New Orleans, a firestorm, over remarks made by Mayor Ray Nagin yesterday. He said black residents will return to New Orleans to make it a chocolate city. Chocolate City also being the title track of a 1975 album from the group Parliament, embracing black majority cities. Further, Nagin said God's anger at the U.S. for the war in Iraq and at black Americans for not taking better care of women and children was the reason for Hurricane Katrina. Well, today Mayor Nagin said he didn't mean his comments to be divisive, and he tried to explain what he meant by chocolate in an interview with WVUE-TV in New Orleans.
Do you know anything about chocolate? How do you make chocolate? You take dark chocolate, you mix it with white milk, and it becomes a delicious drink. That's the chocolate I'm talking about.
Joining us on the line, Shayna Rose, reporter with WWLAM News Radio in New Orleans. Hello.
Thank you, Robin.
And you were there yesterday when the mayor delivered his comments. Can you elaborate on his comments about chocolate?
Well, he didn't really elaborate any more than you've already heard in the soundbite. But the speech was prefaced by a lot of ministers with the prayers, and it was a Martin Luther King Day celebration. And he started his speech by saying it was all about unity, and then went into a speech that most of our listeners have said they found very dividing for the city.
Well, you know, and some have said, on the other hand, that this comment about Chocolate City, it's a phrase that we use derisively by racists such as the KKK in the past, and the mayor might have been trying to turn it into a positive statement while rallying the black residents of the city.
But immediately following the Chocolate City reference, he said, "This city will be African-American again. God wants it that way," or "that's the way God wants it to be," I think is a direct quote. But immediately following the Chocolate City, he elaborated by saying an African-American city. So I don't think there was any doubt in most people's mind when they got to hear the whole speech, and many, many of them got to here in New Orleans yesterday, that is exactly what he was talking about. He wasn't talking about a mixture of white milk and chocolate, whites and blacks.
He also made other comments about white residents in Uptown.
During the chocolate part, he said, I don't care what the folks in Uptown have to say, and many of the people who have returned in the city are Uptown, and many of them are white. Mm.
What about the mayor's comments about Hurricane Katrina being in reaction to God's anger? Of course, everybody's pointed out that Pat Robertson has made the same comments about God punishing, let's say, Ariel Sharon. What's been the reaction to that?
Well, many residents believe he really shouldn't be speaking for God at all. Ministers are also coming out and saying, you know, this is kind of a slippery slope. We don't even go and try to speak for God, much less the mayor, and maybe he left himself open.
Well, Shayna, is this out of character for Mayor Nagin?
He was the most animated I've ever seen him. He was almost shouting at a couple spots, and that's not what I've really seen from the mayor up until now. Now, the city council president says, "The one thing Ray Nagin is not is a racist." But unfortunately, most people here see these comments as very, very, very racist.
And are those people that you're referring to black and white?
Black and white.
Well, Shayna, I'm just wondering, when are local elections scheduled in New Orleans? And what is the thinking about his ability to lead the city?
February 4th was the date the elections were supposed to be held. Katrina, of course, has ruined most election sites. The polling commissioners are scattered to the four winds. I mean, we have basically nothing left to hold an election here. They're trying to get it on for the end of April. There are numerous roadblocks to getting that done, including layer after layer of both state and federal approval for different things. So if that'll happen in April, we don't know. In the meantime, the mayor will be in his office.
And is there concern about that?
Some people on the air are mentioning that, yeah, well, that they won't be voting for the mayor again in the next election because he has proved that he is a racist and they don't believe that he represents all of the people.
Given this tough time in New Orleans and how important leadership is now, have you heard anything as drastic as a move to remove him from office because of these comments?
No calls like that at all yet, but a lot of people are angry. Very, very angry and scared. So many of the residents uptown think that the mayor basically painted a target on their heads, because a lot of people take the things that a mayor says that passionately as if they should react to them. And maybe some young black people need to go out and take the city back forcefully at gunpoint, as the mayor said. So a lot of people are concerned that these remarks can fuel some problems.
They might be seen as a call to arms.
Exactly.
Shayna Rose, a reporter with WWL AM Radio in New Orleans. Shayna, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, now we want to spend some time on the new federally managed Medicare prescription plan. Many seniors across the country are still trying to navigate it. This past weekend, President Bush attempted to fix widespread problems that became evident after his signature program went into effect January 1st. Tens of thousands of seniors across the country were told they weren't in the database, and they left drugstores without medication rather than pay enormous and unexpected copays of up to $250. Nearly two dozen states stepped in as payers of last resort, picking up the seniors' tabs and calling on the White House to fix the situation. And the Bush administration sent a memo to insurers over the weekend, instructing them to, among other things, fill prescriptions for customers already taking drugs for the next month. Top health official Mark McClellan says the program is largely working, but still, tomorrow, Health and Human Services Secretary Mike Leavitt will start a tour to see how things are going in the field. What will he find? Well, we turn first to Angelo DeFazio, a pharmacist and owner of four pharmacies in Connecticut called Arrow Prescription Centers. Angelo, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for having me.
And first of all, have you seen improvements since the Bush administration ordered insurers to not only pay for the drugs these seniors need for this 30-day grace period, but also not charge more than $5 per drug for customers? Have you seen improvement?
There's only improvement, Robin, when the system works correctly. But unfortunately, it still rarely works the way it was intended to work.
And by the way, how much of a part do you think pharmacists played in getting people to pay attention to how it was not working?
The federal government and this nation owes the pharmacist in this country. We would not allow a patient to leave without their prescription. Many pharmacies filled at least partial prescriptions in order for the patient to go with their medicine, but we decided to hand out the full prescription, hoping and praying that somehow we'll be able to adjudicate that claim and be paid properly.
By the way, what was it like in the days after January 1st?
In a simple word, it was a nightmare, and it continues to be a nightmare. When the system worked correctly, it was a gigantic puzzle to put this together. I have 65% Medicaid recipients in my stores. We fill over 5,000 prescriptions a week, all told. And unfortunately, the majority of those were unprepared, and the system that was to create a smooth transition did not work properly.
Well, let's explain, because we do understand that about 65% of your customers, as you said, are on Medicaid, and the majority of those are also on Medicare. Let's remind ourselves, Medicare is the supplemental program for the elderly, Medicaid the federal program for the poor and disabled. Medicaid becomes a secondary insurer for the elderly who qualify, so they are on both Medicare and Medicaid. And as we've learned, not all of the elderly who are on Medicare had to choose a plan. Some had state or private plans that they liked better. But Medicaid recipients did have to choose a plan. If they didn't, they were automatically put on one. How did that impact your problems?
Well, that caused a dilemma for us because there were 11 auto-enrolled plans in our state. So here's the problem. There's 11 plans with 11 different ways to process a prescription, with 11 different ways to enter the information. To get a hold of the information was not a smooth transition. Some of the information wasn't there. Dates of birth were incorrectly sent to the private plan that is now going to pay for the patient's prescription.
And we understand that many of these people on Medicaid, I'm thinking my mom was one at that point, were ill, disabled. They had no idea that they were automatically transferred.
They didn't. They were aware that something was happening, the majority of them, but they were told, don't worry, go to the pharmacy and everything will be the same, and it wasn't at all. Now, the plans have gotten better. There's no question it's gotten better, but the burden has been 100% on the pharmacy.
Well, what were some of the specific problems that you faced? You know, we understand the phone lines were busy, but what were some of the, you know, technical problems you faced?
The problems were with an overwhelming number of calls to the National Center at the National Data Corps, NDC, that is the troop facilitator. This troop facilitator was going to create a smooth transition so that we can query that system, find out exactly what the Medicaid recipient's plan is, then we can get the information from that system, put it into our computers to access the private plan and make sure the patient is covered and find out what the proper copay is and see what your reimbursement is going to be for that drug.
Hmm.
Well, the hold time is unbelievable. Trying to get information is unbelievable. When you do finally get through, often the information that's given to you still doesn't work in the computer, so they're still working out their problems.
Well, we understand some of the big pharmacy chains, such as Walgreens, are giving out the prescriptions fully, just expecting that insurers are going to reimburse them down the road. Can you do that?
We are doing that, but I am terrified of the economic impact if it doesn't take place. If I had to create a value on a prescription, how much economic time and effort goes into a prescription? Last year, for that Medicaid patient, let's say it was a one. Well, to fill that same prescription today, in the beginning of the implementation, it was tenfold. Today, it's still fivefold. So I'm wondering how we're going to be made whole. How is the pharmacist going to be made whole in this transition period?
Well, I'm also
we're the ones that are keeping it together.
I'm also wondering, you know, there are some drugstores who do not work with Medicaid. I'm wondering if there are going to be drugstores who will drop Medicaid care if they just can't handle it, and where will those customers go?
Access has always been a problem with the Medicaid population, so I'm very concerned about access, because the worst fear I have is medication interruption. That's why we refuse not to give the prescription out. We will give the prescription out, and we'll give the whole prescription out, and we hope and pray that the government in its good faith and these plans in their good faith will make us whole.
Well, Mark McClellan, who's head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, as we said, says the new plan is working for the vast number of participants. He says about 2 million people have voluntarily signed up so far. That exceeds the government's projections. And we also should say there are some druggists who've had no problem. One wonders if, you know, they had just Medicare or if they also had Medicaid patients. And as we said, the president has called for this 30-day grace period. Do you think that's enough to straighten this out?
Today, no. Hopefully in 30 days, the answer is yes. My concern is that I'm almost a precursor of what's to come. Because of my large population of Medicaid patients, I've been inundated, and many prescriptions are affected for me. In suburban America, or where there isn't a lot of Medicaid recipients, it's a much smoother transition. But for me, it was here it is all at one time, and nothing was working. It's definitely gotten better. Please understand that it has gotten better, but it's not perfect yet. It's nowhere near being perfect yet, and we haven't received our adjudicated claims yet to see exactly what transpired. So I'm hoping that the government, behind the scenes, working with the states, working with the plans, makes the pharmacy whole again.
Angela DeFazio, a pharmacist and owner of four drugstores called the Arrow Prescription Centers in Hartford, Connecticut. Angela, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Robin, thank you very much for having me.
And just ahead, we'll get response from the Bush administration. We'll also hear from the governor of New Hampshire on how state governments have had to step in and help out. And don't forget, later in the program, a 60s flashback, Donovan. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're continuing our conversation about the new Medicare Drug Benefit Program for senior citizens. On January 1st, many problems arose, and critics, such as the pharmacist we just heard from, say the government should have foreseen that a huge number of Medicaid recipients who were automatically enrolled in a Medicare program just before the January 1st deadline would swamp the system. But Leslie Norwalk of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services says it's not the 6 million or so Americans who were automatically enrolled in a plan when they didn't make a choice of their own that's the problem. It's that about 500,000 of them then changed their plan. Leslie, can you explain?
What we're finding across the country is that those beneficiaries who switched from one plan to another at some point in time in the between November 15th and the end of the year, that's where the majority of our problems have come up.
Well, and that raises so many questions. One of them being, why are there so many plans? In Connecticut, for instance, there are 11 plans in that one state with 11 very different complicated ways to access information for the pharmacist who's used to, you know, punching in the numbers. We've all seen them do it. Why so many plans?
Well, the number of plans really is something that can be great for beneficiaries because they can choose plans that have complete coverage from January to December for a premium, typically in the $60 range. Or they can choose a plan that is significantly less expensive that would have less coverage. They can choose a plan that provides generics for free. So depending on the particular need of an individual, there is a plan that can be just right for them. And I appreciate that people are concerned about how do they make that choice. And there is one place that all beneficiaries can call, and that's 1-800-MEDICARE, where we have operators 24 hours a day, days a week.
But as you well know, these helplines have been completely gridlocked since January 1.
Well, the 1-800-MEDICARE line we're seeing actually has excellent access. And from a pharmacy perspective, one of the things that we've put into place is a system where a pharmacist can use his computer system or her computer system to determine where a beneficiary is enrolled so that in a split second, a pharmacist can look it up on an eligibility query.
One of the owners of one of the plans, right off the bat when problems began, occurring, apologized. Should the government also apologize?
We all regret that anyone ever has had a problem. And some of the plans have had more issues than others, and that may be for computer reasons or whatever else. And that's irrelevant. The fact of the matter is every beneficiary who's entitled to get a prescription at the pharmacy at a particular copayment, that's what they need to get. And that's what we're working toward every day, all day long, 24/7.
Leslie, what have you been hearing from the states? We know, for instance, in New Hampshire, lawmakers there just agreed to spend up to $500,000 on medications for seniors to sort of be a safety net. And we know governors, Republican and Democrat, have been pretty angry. What are you hearing?
Some states, there are very few problems at all whatsoever. In other states, they're seeing much more. Now, in terms of the state wrapping around or helping here, we've provided some instructions to states to make it as easy as possible so that as these things work themselves out, as the computer systems are improved as they are on an hourly basis, that if the state is helping those beneficiaries pay, that we can make the process of reconciliation as easy as possible so that the state can be reimbursed from the plans when they put money out on behalf of the beneficiary.
Leslie Norwalk, Deputy Administrator for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid in Washington, D.C. Leslie, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, as we said, several state governments intervened when problems arose with the new Medicare prescription plan, and one of them was New Hampshire. Governor John Lynch joins us on the line now. Welcome, Governor Lynch.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Well, we know that in the aftermath of the first problems, you signed an executive order authorizing your state to pick up these disputed drug claims. And we know that yesterday, legislators there in New Hampshire agreed to spend $500,000 on these medications for seniors so they'd have a safety net. But we also hear that, and I'm reading in the Concord Monitor, just over the weekend, pharmacists billed the state 228 times. Is $500,000 going to be enough?
I think it will last for a number of weeks. This program has really been a nightmare for many of our seniors. Lots of reports of seniors showing up and not being able to get their medication, not being able to get their prescription drugs, not being in the system. And pharmacists are being told they need to go through this 14-step process, which is very cumbersome. Step three of the process requires them to make a phone call. When they make the call, the line is busy. And we're doing what we can to protect our seniors. We'll worry about the reimbursement aspect later, but we want our seniors who need their medication to be able to go to the pharmacy and get their medication without being told that they either are not covered or have to pay a lot of money for it. In some cases, this is a life or death, or could be a life or death situation.
Well, now, we just heard from Leslie Norwalk, Deputy Administrator for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. You mentioned reimbursement. She said the states will be reimbursed. But also, she and some others say that it's getting better, that the snafus at the beginning of the month had to do with the sort of overload of the system from Medicaid patients who were automatically transferred at the end of the waiting period, right before the deadline. Do you think it's getting better?
We haven't seen it yet. I think the whole system for the implementation of Medicare Part D should have been tested, and it obviously wasn't tested as thoroughly as it should have. And basically then our seniors have to suffer because of the incompetence of the federal government.
Well, what do you say to those who might say that people like you might just be making this a political football? You're, after all, a Democratic governor, and there's been criticism of federal response to both this prescription plan and before that Hurricane Katrina. And for the first time, some states are going to have to absorb some more costs because for the first time, some people on Medicaid, the poor, the elderly, and disabled, are going to have to be making co-payments on their prescriptions, and the states will have to pick that up. So, you know, what do you say to those who are just saying, oh, this is, you're just disgruntled?
Well, we came to together in a very bipartisan way after hearing so many concerns from our seniors and our pharmacists. Speaker of the House is a Republican. The Senate president is a Republican. And we all came together. They were with me when I signed the executive order. And then they called a special session, and I immediately signed the bill that they passed appropriating $500,000 to cover this. But ultimately, the federal government has to make sure this works. It's a federal program.
Governor John Lynch of New Hampshire. Governor, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Well, stay with us. We have much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Responding to concern among stockholders, the Securities and Exchange Commission is expected to vote today on proposals to make CEO salaries more transparent. And what are some of those salaries? Well, Forbes magazine reports that Yahoo's chief executive earned the most of any CEO last year, $230 million and change. But does that amount include perks? Invisible perks and bonuses are usually not spelled out in company annual reports, and critics say that's a problem. Joining us on the line is Boston University law professor Tamar Frankel, an expert on corporate governance and author of the new book, Trust and Honesty, America's Business Culture at a Crossroad. And Professor, some people question the morality of CEOs earning so much. But do CEO salaries affect the bottom line? Do they take money away from workers or stockholders?
Well, there's more than just taking away and just morality. The question is, have they earned it? If they have earned it, for example, like film stars or sports stars, then nobody would question. But unlike the stars, the managers are not the source and not necessarily always the source of what the corporation earns. Sometimes it can be somebody in the trenches who does it.
Well, as you well know, there are critics of that thinking. Steve Kaplan, finance professor at the University of Chicago, says that the average CEO is probably underpaid these days because of the demands of the job.
Well, the demands may be high, but so are the demands of somebody who digs ditches. So the demand is not the issue. The issue is, do they produce? And that is iffy. It depends. Some do, some don't.
Well, putting aside for a second the size of the salaries, which is an issue, the SEC is taking a look at how transparent these salaries are. How are portions of salaries hidden for CEOs?
Some would tell you that they are not very large, but what has happened in the last 10 years or so is that salaries that used to be described in terms of dollars are now in terms of soft dollars. For example, huge amounts of loans that are given at a very attractive rate or maybe at no rate at all. Who knows?
I'm thinking, for instance, of Jack Welch, the legendary CEO of GE, when after he left the SEC, took a pretty tough look at his salary, found perks, use of a company airplane and other perks that amounted to millions of dollars. How else is CEO salary hidden? What other ways?
Well, they get second homes, and the maintenance of, for example, an apartment in New York may be very costly. So they get charitable contributions to the institutions of their choice, and that can amount to an awful lot of money.
There's also stock options, very controversial point. How do you feel about CEOs being given so many stock options?
I don't think it's a good idea. On the one hand, When you get a stock option, you pay nothing. If you get a share, you pay and take the risk. What has happened is that there is a tremendous drive, at least by some, not by all, by any means, but by some, to then begin to cook the books.
So you think that a CEO actually having a lot of stock options might affect decisions that he makes about the future of the company?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct.
And in what other ways might he or she do that?
You might want to take short-term planning, but also short-term risks that will come to roost only after somebody would leave the corporation, or just before you leave the corporation.
Or you might even sell the corporation because of the windfall that you might get when it might not be the best thing for the corporation?
That's what we call golden parachutes, and these may be enormously large when the corporation is being sold.
Yeah. How are big companies receiving this idea of reform? Is anyone fighting it?
On the whole, I see an approval. And the approval stems both, I think, from the fear of shame or from the fear that people are very, very angry, but also from the desire to establish trust. And here is people who say, okay, we have nothing to hide. Just look at us. We are bare. And that brings in trust. Where will the problems arise? There is a provision in the proposal that the directors ought to disclose what were the considerations that led them to approve such salaries. Mm-hmm. I think that little section may bring in a great deal of criticism.
How so?
Because it may be very difficult to really show the connection between how well the corporation does and how well its CEO does.
Right. But couldn't it also backfire? Because critics are saying that this transparency with CEO salaries might actually reveal to competing CEOs what others are making, and it might actually drive the salaries up.
That is correct. We are at the stage where we can speculate an enormous amount. Let's find out what is happening. But I have another idea. If we want to really increase shame, we should encourage the small people, the small investors, to express what they think. I suggested that in the proxy statement, there would be just a question that would say, what do you think about the CEO's compensation? Is it too high? Is it just right? Is it too low? That would send a message, a very powerful message, to both the directors and the CEOs that they've gone too far.
Tamar Frankel, professor of law at Boston University, talking about the reforms that the SEC is considering regarding CEO salaries. Ticking through some of them, the SEC is considering requiring companies to state how CEO salaries are arrived at, what salary gains a CEO stands to make if there's a successful merger, lowering the reporting threshold for CEO perks to 10,000 from 50,000, and spelling out what earnings a CEO might receive from a retirement plan. I just want to ask you, Professor Frankel, your book is entitled Trust and Honesty, America's Business Culture at a Crossroad. Briefly, what's that crossroad?
Well, maybe I should start by saying what I see now is more acceptance and more justification and sometimes even redefinition of dishonesty. People say, everybody does it. What can I do?
Or everyone makes it.
Everybody makes
salaries,
it. Yeah. If the CEO makes it, why shouldn't I try too? And the moment this becomes a culture, that means a social habit, when people don't even think about it, they make the assumptions that the others are dishonest, at that point, we are going to have a second-rate economy. It costs.
And it costs to have those high salaries?
To have not only those high salaries, but dishonesty in general.
Tamar Frankel, professor of law at Boston University and author of Trust and Honesty, America's Business Culture at a Crossroad. You're listening to Here and Now.
Thank you. sunshine came softly through my window today. Could have tripped out DC, but I've changed my way.
40 years ago, that song took the British singer Donovan straight to the top of the charts and to the inner circle of 60s rock. Dubbed the British Dylan, he hung out with Bob and Joan Baez, Jimi Hendrix, and Brian Jones. These were heady, incense, and LSD-saturated times, rarefied air for a working-class kid from Glasgow. Donovan Leitch meditated with the Beatles in India. He wrote lyrics for their Yellow Submarine and John's Dear Julia. George wrote a verse for Donovan's Hurdy-Gurdy Man. His own mellow yellow secured Donovan's place as a 60s icon. In fact, Time magazine coined the phrase flower power to describe him. Then, with 13 hit singles, sold-out performances around the world, and his songs recorded by over 200 artists, he hit 24 and quit. Now 59, Donovan has a new compilation of music reissues, a tour, and an autobiography. It's called The Hurdy-Gurdy Man, and he joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Donovan, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
So where you been?
All over. But I never went anywhere. You know, the journey always leads to where you begin. I just got bored and didn't do a lot of stuff. But having made about 35 albums during my career, I think I'm doing okay.
Let's tell people why, for those who weren't there in the 60s. At 19, you'd already had great success, but it was so starkly different from your early years. You had quite a tough start in life. Tell us a little bit about that, where you were born, and what that was like.
Well, I was born in Glasgow. It was a hard, tough granite city, but my father softened my childhood by reading poetry to me. Filled me up with a diet of Celtic mythology, socialism, and poetry from a very early age. An Irish mother, my Scottish and Irish father, the traditions of folk music was very strong. And I moved then from Glasgow at the age of 10 down to the south of England, following my father as he went for work in the south.
What was some of the music that you were listening to as you grew up?
Well, as a teen, I listened to the Everly Brothers and pop singles. But at the same time, I was fascinated by this American artist, Buddy Holly. I just was so taken by him. And I didn't know until later that he produced his own works, he wrote his own works, and he performed his own works, something that I would go on to do. But then I went into college. I was headed for art school. I was headed to be a painter, and I knew Bohemia was where I would have to go.
You write, I am at last in the Bohemian world where I belong, the Beats and the poets, and this guy named Bob Dylan. You write, Bob Dylan and Joan Baez were the king and queen of folk, and you were the prince. This is, of course, after appearing on television shows, and you've captured the imagination of people in Britain. You were called the British Dylan.
Yeah, there was confusion. The cap and the harmonica that Bob wore and the cap and the harmonica that I wore was really an homage to the great American Woody Guthrie.
Yellow is the color of my true love's here in the morning. When we rise in the morning, when we rise, that's the time, that's the time I love the best.
The link between Bob and I was quite obvious, I suppose, but they thought I was following Bob when Bob and I were following Guthrie.
But settle this big controversy for us. I mean, Bob Dylan sings about you in Talking World War III Blues, and his fans were angry at you. What was that about?
I don't know. When we met, it was during May of 65, when I was on tour with a hit record in the charts. Joan Baez was about to release her first single, There But For Fortune, and Dylan was releasing a single called Times Are Changing. The folk world was invading pop culture that spring, and people got very, very hot under the collar. Either you were for Donovan or you were for Dylan. So there was a competition going on. The two Ds, we were everywhere.
Well, Donovan is back after a 35-year absence, and we have a lot of catching up to do, so we're going to take a break. And when we come back, ask about, well, his relationship with the Beatles, for one thing. Stay tuned. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Donovan Leitch shook up the British pop world in his mild, mellow yellow kind of way. His hits filled the airwaves on both sides of the Atlantic, a soundtrack for the psychedelic pop art flower power infused 60s. Here's another of Donovan's classics, 1967's There Is a Mountain.
The lock up on my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. The lock up on my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is.
Almost 40 years later, Donovan has a new autobiography, The Hurdy-Gurdy Man, an account of the years when he was constantly being compared, not always favorably, to Bob Dylan. But as he tells us, it was Bob Dylan who introduced him to the Beatles.
I went around to see Bob to say goodbye. They were leaving the next day, and I was shown into the darkened suite. Lights were low. Television was showing the ice skating champion. Some Austrian gal in a miniskirt circling the ice, and Bob said, come in, Dan, sit down. So I sat down, cross-legged on the floor, became aware of other shapes, and one of the other figures leant close to me and said, hello, Donovan, how are you? And the accent was unmistakable, of course. It was John. And Bob stood and put the light on and said, have you met these guys? And so began a relationship with those four guys from Liverpool, which I didn't realize how close we really were until the history book said that Donovan spent more musical, social, and spiritual time with the Beatles than any of his generation of songwriters. And it's true.
Cross-pollinating quite a bit, as we said, writing each other's lyrics. I want to go back to something you just said about your visit with the Bob Dylan and the Beatles, that you'd had a little smoke.
Ooh, hash.
Boy. Hash, marijuana. You imbibed quite a bit. I mean, I'm surprised you made it through the 60s.
No more than any other bohemian. Smoke is the soft drug. You don't get sick on pot and hash. You really get sick on heroin and cocaine and alcohol and tobacco and all the heavy stuff. I never really was into the heavy stuff.
They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow.
You say you weren't promoting drugs. I never knew. I love Sunshine Superman. I had no idea that sunshine was a slang term for LSD.
Yeah, but it's also multi-leveled. You know, Sunshine, the Superman in the comics was brawn. He was physical. And so I wanted to present the Superman of Nietzsche. Thus spoke Zarathustra, the Superman of the inner world. And soon that Superman, that feminine side of the male would come forward, and we poets could once again enter popular culture and sing of meaningful, tender lyrics, which are not just the moon in June and I love you, why do you make me blue? The real bohemian invasion of the charts was begun by Kerouac and Ginsberg and Burroughs and Ferlinghetti and Rexroth, and they said real poetry should be returned to popular culture, to the masses. By the way, that's another establishment thing. They separate the poet from the masses and feed the masses trivia, really. And so we as bohemians had a mission as well.
I didn't realize, again, till reading your book, that Hurdy-Gurdy Man was a protest song.
Well, is it? I can't remember saying that, but somebody also, a young fan, said, is it about the apocalypse? You see, poetry is a series of words in their very best order, and they can mean many things to many. The intention in the song, of course, was that it would take many years, perhaps, but truth will be returned to popular culture. And in that second verse, down through all eternity, the crying of humanity, it's then when the hurdy-gurdy men come singing songs of love.
Hurdy-gurdy men come singing songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy men come singing songs of love.
How could you not do this for 40 years? I'm listening to you. You always had such a voice, as you're right in the middle of this heavy, heady time. How have you been able to not be on the stage?
Well, it would become like a steady job, and you see, it's got to be fun as well. And I've already done so much by the age of 24 in 1970. I need not have done anything else. The music has been presented. The mission was to introduce poetry again to popular culture. And so, having done it, why would I keep doing it? Also, it became quite dangerous, fame, and I got a bit scared of it. I didn't quite understand how to continue.
You're right, the spell is starting to break, and perhaps a mini nervous breakdown was happening for you.
Yeah, it was an identity crisis, although I was buying into fame in the sense that I would be the actor of my songs, and where would it end? It is a dangerous position to be in, and you can get lost, but in actually presenting the Bohemian Manifesto on mass television and radio was where it was headed. And so leaving the business was only temporary.
But I'm wondering, as I read the book and read that you showed John Lennon how to do finger-picking guitar playing, you've already said you were one of the first to put meaningful poetic lyrics in pop culture. You played electric guitar at Wembley 5 months before Bob Dylan did at Newport.
I didn't know about all this until I looked into it.
Oh, and there's more. You and Paul Horn really might have been the inventors of New Age music. And I'm just wondering if a part of writing this book is maybe Donovan taking what you see as your rightful place, you know, in the pantheon of rock stars.
Actually, I just looked at the facts and looked at the lyrics that were happening in late 64 on popular records, and then looked at the lyrics I was writing, and so I immediately saw I was presenting the first alternative lyrics. Other folk singer-songwriters had introduced poetic lyrics to their albums, and that was called the folk world. So, to be very clear, I am the first who introduces meaningful poetry to a pop chart.
But you're saying this now in retrospect, you know, looking back at your life, and I'm thinking, gee, it's too darn bad you didn't know it then, because you also write, at the time, I had no measure of my own worth. And I'm thinking, but you were Donovan!
No, we're all insecure, you know, and artists are more insecure than others. We have an extraordinary power to express our emotions forward, out. But that comes from a lot of suffering inside. It can't be otherwise. If you read the books of Buddhism, you find that it is through great suffering that the breakthrough happens. And you must come to terms with it. Each of us must. So I had a private life as well as a public life. Mm.
Donovan Leitch, he's got a new autobiography, a new compilation, a new tour.
Yeah, I'm back.
You're back.
I'm back from Atlantis. Did you miss me?
Yes, we did.
Oh, I bring in the 40th anniversary my songs of love and compassion. And love and compassion we need more now than ever.
Donovan, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Hail Atlantis.
All right, everyone, wave your hands left to right. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.